This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off. The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Well, we've seen the policy launches, we've read through the manifestos, and what have we learned? Labour are so keen to cut the deficit that they'd pass a law forcing themselves to do so, but they won't give an end date for austerity. Meanwhile, the Conservatives promise to plough billions into the health service and bring about a return to the good life, but won't say where they're getting the money. And the Lib Dems hedged their bets but promised to have more brains than Labour and more heart than the Tories. So with no party at all confident of winning outright in May and all policies likely to be up for trade in a post-election pact, are manifestos worth the glossy paper they're written on? And what happens after the election if a coalition can't be formed and no single party commands the Commons? Joining me for all of this, we have our economics editor, Larry Elliott, our social affairs editor, Randeep Ramesh, and the author of a new book, Who Governs Britain, Anthony King. A warm welcome to you all. So it's Manifesto Week, and Labour went first on Monday with Ed Miliband returning to Manchester, the city where he forgot to mention the deficit in the autumn. This time he said Labour would legislate to make sure that they'd remember next time. Now, Larry, Labour saying the deficit's going to be falling every year, and there's this kind of talk about a law and a guarantee. It sounded like he was trying to say we're just as trustworthy as the Tories are on the deficit, and yet some people are saying there's still a big difference between the parties on this stuff.
Yeah, he's trying to get rid of a big Labour negative, which is that people don't trust Labour on the economy. And they lost that trust during the deep recession of 2008-09. And they've spent four or five years trying to rebuild it. And that's what this pledge is all about, really. It's not actually as tough a pledge as it sounds, because if you imagine what would happen if there was another recession sometime during the next parliament, would Labour actually make the recession worse by ensuring that borrowing was going to fall year on year on year, which is what they've pledged to do? No, they would actually allow borrowing to rise. So there would have to be some sort of override in any event. And Labour's policy is actually a lot more modest in terms of deficit reduction than that of the government. Labour says it will borrow to invest in capital spending. Quite a sensible policy. Interest rates are very low. Britain's got lots of investment needs. It's not a bad policy at all. The Conservatives say they want to run an overall budget surplus, which means not only the day-to-day running costs of government, but also capital spending, which is a much, much bigger deficit reduction package, at least £30 billion more than Labour will be doing. So there is quite a big difference between the parties. Labour's sounding tough because it knows it's got an image problem when it comes to the economy and being in charge of the finances. It's tried very hard with this manifesto to try and change those perceptions. 3 weeks away from election, you have to say, a bit late in the day.
Anthony, I mean, isn't the purpose of manifestos meant to be to clarify the choice that's before the electorate? And yet Larry's saying there's quite a big difference there, but the purpose of it for Labour was to suggest there wasn't
well,
a big
Well, there are manifestos there. And there's propaganda. And what Labour needs to do is score on the propaganda front. And that involves taking that message, the one that Larry referred to, and repeating it and repeating it and repeating it to the point where it sinks in. Whether people then believe it is another question. One of the problems that the Labour Party hasn't confronted over the last few years, ever since Ed Miliband became leader, is the willingness to be repetitious, the willingness to pick up themes, tell stories, and go on telling them over time. A manifesto by itself accomplishes almost nothing. I think you said a moment ago that we've all read the manifestos. Well, maybe the people in this studio have, but the great people out there haven't and aren't going to. The manifestos are more likely, as you also said, to become important in terms of the currency of negotiations.
Randeep, did you spot anything beyond the economy about on the Labour document about, you know, what kind of country Ed Miliband wants to lead?
Well, I think Tony's right. I mean, in the sense that Labour's narrative has been broken up, whether Ed Miliband was a predator versus, a
producer,
thank you, or whether he was a One Nation Labourite, or whether he was just a sort of deep purple Labourite. No one kind of figured it out over the years.
So actually what you're both saying is we need a slogan and to be more boring and to repeat it more often sort of thing.
Well, it's that sort of education, or NHS. I mean, that's a tried and tested tactic. I think with the Labour Party, the sort of main themes, I think, have been about the redistribution of power for Miliband. So he was brave over AV, where he did say politics is broken, we need to fix it. He was brave over Rupert Murdoch, where he said there is a pole of power, uncontrolled, unaccountable power, the British media, we do need reform of it. And it frankly was brave over large parts of British capitalism, which represent over concentrated, unaccountable bits of power, whether that's the energy industry or whether it's land banking. He has put forward policies, and I suspect...
But this is all stuff that, I mean, that he's built up over the years. And the manifesto, you're saying, was essentially knitting that together into a bit more...
But I do agree with Tony that he didn't provide a narrative for it, and that was the problem. That was the problem.
I don't know. I mean, I kind of felt like there was a narrative in there somewhere, Larry, didn't you? I mean, it was a bit confused because you got the kind of, we will be like the Conservatives on the deficit propaganda on the cover. But the rest of it about those things Randeep's talking about, you know, about the irresponsible capitalism.
I'm a bit more positive than that. I think that the deficit reduction bit was there so that it gave him the space to do some of the other more creative stuff.
I heard a whisper, it was sneaked in late in the evening.
And so there is a direction of travel there, which is, I think that Ed is someone who thinks there's something actually wrong about the way British capitalism works, and that the period between 1997 and 2010 highlighted some of those problems, and that Labour needs to actually move on from the Blair Brown years and forge a new form of political economy. I mean, that's still work in progress, but you can see the direction of travel there.
And you've got stuff on top pay and pension funds having to show their hands on top pay if they want to nod it through. Would those things start to make a difference?
And I think to an extent that does resonate with, but a lot of people do think there's been something that's gone quite wrong with the way Britain has worked over the last 10 or 15 years, that we had a financial crisis caused by the banks, and yet the bankers seem to just sort of swan on and still pick up their bonuses. There's an awful lot of bubbling resentment, I think, out there, which Ed is trying to tap into. I think that the problem he's had throughout, and this comes back to something Tony said, which is the Conservatives, right from the start, have had a narrative and they've stuck to it, which is that we picked up problems inherited from Labour. Labour created this mess. We are having to impose austerity because of the bad things that Labour did to the economy, and that you cannot trust Labour to be put back in charge of the economy again. And that's been a very, very repetitious message, but they've banged it out constantly right from day one of this parliament, right from day one, right up till now. They've carried on.
This is Anthony's bang the drum and bang it again and again.
They've had total message discipline. And I think it's actually percolated down. I don't think people really think about politics that much in their everyday lives. We do. But actually most people get on with their lives, think about who they're going to vote for once every 5 years, but things do start to seep down deep into their consciousness. And one of them is Labour screwed up the economy, and Labour's found it very hard to actually get rid of that taint.
I think the Labour Party has simply failed. I've been very struck by this conversation. Everybody else in the studio attends to day-to-day politics, what's happening in terms of housing, what's happening in terms of inflation or whatever. I don't. I have a different kind of day job. And I think I've learned more about what Labour is on about in the last 5 or 10 minutes than I've learned in the last 5 or 10 months. The people who attend to these things, and you are honorary members of the political class. I'm not quite, I aspire to be, but I'm not quite making it. And I don't know what's filtered down to people. I think the answer is that what is filtered down is Labour on the whole doesn't much like the rich, and that's been translated by the Conservatives into Labour doesn't on the whole like business, and Labour hasn't had and much to say about that. Labour has also, I think, managed to persuade people that the Labour Party cares about the poor, but then most people aren't poor, and it's not entirely clear that they've managed to move out from that point to persuade, dare I say it in this room, middle England, that there's something in it for them, or at least that they won't be damaged.
But these things you're talking about, you know, we could go back to the 50s or maybe even the 30s and people would have some of those impressions of Labour and the and the Conservatives. So these are sort of like the absolute irreducible core of the brand, if you like, of both parties, aren't they? I mean, it's not anything to do with what Ed Miliband's done or David Cameron's done particularly.
Well, if I were not Tony King but Tony Blair, I would agree with you, and I would say the whole purpose of a modern Labour Party ought to be to try to move out from its brand image and seize other territory, as the Conservatives have succeeded in doing for the last, 150 years. I mean, the Tories have been very good and very successful over election after election after election of getting people who are not natural Conservatives to vote Conservative because they look safe and sound. And
you mean people who don't have dinner with Lord Salisbury?
That type, yes.
Randy, one thing that jumped out of the Conservative manifesto, properly cautioned by Tony that it might be that no one's read it, but for those of us who did, there was this business about extending right to buy. That works for people in council houses at the moment, and they're saying it would be for housing associations now as well. Is that a big change?
Well, it's actually not that big a change for the Conservative Party, because it was David Davis's policy in 2005, which he, which was very successful in England because it saw the Tories get more votes than Labour for the first time in a long time electorally. It was dropped, I think, partly because of the personality clash between David Davis and David Cameron. And then David Cameron has revived it on the basis that it's a very popular because giving something for nothing to a bunch of voters who wouldn't normally or might be described as swing voters at best is a good policy. Whether it's a good policy in terms of the British state, I think, is another matter. I think it's probably
the housing. Everyone keeps saying housing's the big issue.
Yeah, housing is a big issue, but the aftershocks of the council house sell-off is to see a third of former council housing stock in the hands of rich private landlords, a concentration of power which we're finding difficult to remove. Regulating the housing market is a problem. Taking away social housing, housing provided for people on very low incomes, and giving it to people on the basis that they now have a free asset, I don't think it's a very good thing, even unless you replace the housing stock. Because the need's still there.
That's what it comes down to, isn't it? And there was always the argument in the 80s, wasn't it, about whether or not new houses were going to get built to replace council houses were sold, which for the most part they didn't, and we can see the housing lists. Now, Larry, I read this bit of the Conservative manifesto closely, and it just said, to make sure the houses that are sold off can be replaced, we will encourage councils to organise their assets better.
Well, clearly this policy is going to make the housing crisis in Britain worse. It's going to increase demand, and it's not going to, and supply won't keep up. That's been the message of right to buy all the way back to the 80s, that you flog off more houses than you build. And this is going to add to that problem. But actually, it's not really about economics or even the housing market. This is all about political positioning, which is that the Conservatives want to be seen as the party on the side of people with aspiration who want to own their own home, and they're laying a trap there for Labour. What they really want for Labour to do is come out and say, we oppose this, because then Labour looks like the party that's not aspirational. So yeah. It's in a way it's the equivalent of Labour's putting on the front of its manifesto its deficit reduction pledge. Yeah. It's a piece of carefully honed political positioning which will do absolutely nothing to solve Britain's house. The way to solve Britain's housing problem is to build more houses. End of story. That's the answer, not to actually force housing associations to sell off their housing stock.
So it strikes me they're trying to get back to some of the mood of the 1980s here. There is a big difference, isn't there? At that time, there was felt to be an inexorable kind of century-long tide towards more and more people owning their own house. And for about 10 years now, that's gone into reverse. I'm trying to work out, Anthony, whether this makes things a more popular policy or a policy that seems like it's from another planet.
I suspect the Conservatives have chosen that policy very sensibly for the kinds of reasons that Larry has just given. Incidentally, the Conservative track record on housing is an interesting one. They've twice wrong-footed the Labour Party historically. Going way back into the past, it was the Conservatives who, in 1951, promised to build 300,000 houses a year, and they did. By the way, most of them were council houses, but let's pass on that. And then, of course, they picked up the cause of the right to buy, of letting people buy their council houses. It's not at all obvious to me that that was a sensible thing for Labour to oppose, because that could be presented as a big transfer of capital to people who didn't have capital. They now could have capital assets. It would have been a brilliant policy, I think, from Labour's point of view, if, but only if, as Larry's implied, the proceeds from those sales had then been used to increase the housing stock. But the Conservatives have quite consistently, I think, to use the phrase I used before, wrong-footed the Labour Party on this, and it looks as though they may have done it again.
Jim Callaghan did actually have consider right to buy back in 78, 79. I think there was a proposal put forward by the think tank, I think by Bernard Donoghue and Gavin Davis, this very same policy.
Well, actually, it was a Labour policy from the 50s. It was
the 59 manifesto.
And it wasn't actually followed through with.
No. I mean, it was a Labour. And curiously enough, this policy that has just been announced, on the right of the Labour Party, you have Frank Field, who wrote a pamphlet in 2012 advocating just this policy.
I mean, one of the big differences between now and the early 80s is that house prices have just boomed so much since the early 90s. So when you got a big discount in the early 80s, you could afford to take up the mortgage. I think quite a lot of people might have a different view of this now, which is that even with the discount, they are going to struggle to actually buy their homes because the valuations are so much higher. And I think quite a lot of people realise that there is a problem, particularly in London and the South East, with affordability. That, the reason, Tom, that the number of the percentage of people owning their own homes is going down is because people are effectively being priced out of the market by sky-high house prices, and they just cannot afford to actually get them. They can't get a mortgage.
With the discount.
Even with the discount. And I think, I just wonder whether this will have quite the same degree of political purchase as it did for Mrs. Thatcher in the early 1980s.
Very quickly, we should talk, Randeep, about the Liberal Democrats. I'm not going to ask you, Tony, because you made plain that you're not reading the detail of all the manifestos, but did you spot anything of interest in the document they produced yesterday?
Well, I thought it was... it's written by David Laws, so it has a very orange feel to it. The Liberal Democrats, in my mind, are fighting an election really to preserve the 21 out of 29 Tory versus Lib Dem marginal. So it's a very kind of coalition-esque type document on the right of the party. The thing that really struck me wasn't in the manifesto so I could read it, was Nick Clegg saying that even if they would keep on reducing the structural deficit, even if they had reached kind of budget deficit. I mean, if they cleared the deficit, they would still go for the structural deficit, i.e. you reach full employment and you're still going to cut after that. It seemed, and this was quoted approvingly in The Sun, of all places, it seemed a signal that they wanted to be sort of so muscular as to be ideological about this position, about cutting the deficit, to prove that they had real metal in their soul.
I mean, I noticed that of the five policies they highlighted on the front, for a start, they didn't have anything about PR, political reform, which was always their big thing. But three of those five were already kind of Tory policy.
I think the authorship by David Laws tells you a lot about where the party's headed.
Do you think they're finished, the Lib Dems, in this election, or do you think they're going to surprise us and hold on pretty tenaciously?
I think probably neither. I think they're going to survive, and I think they're going to get a fair number of seats on the basis of candidates who are deeply dug in. And they may well be in a position to decide. Last time, they didn't really hold the balance of power.
No.
They had to go with the Conservatives. There just weren't enough Labour and Labour types around. This time, they might actually hold the balance of power. And that leads one...
So they lose half their votes, they could have more clout than they did last time.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the new name of the political game. But one of the things that strikes me is that partly because, frankly, there aren't enough journalists around any longer, we're not being told enough about the internal politics of political parties, and in particular the Lib Dems. Mm. Because although this manifesto may have been written, and probably was, by David Laws, if the Lib Dems then, as it were, on auto pilot, got back into bed. Oh, a terrible mix of metaphors. Yeah. Anyway, got back into bed with the Conservatives. There would be a hell of a lot of Lib Dems out there in the country who would be very unhappy about this, and there would probably be quite a lot of Lib Dem MPs who felt the same thing. They managed the trick 5 years ago of going as a united party in one direction. Whether they'd manage that again this time, I'm not less clear.
Well, if we don't get a clear winner next month, politics could start to get very strange indeed. Passing anything at all in the House of Commons could become a sort of attritional battle of the kind last seen in the 1970s. But as the former Cabinet Secretary Gus O'Donnell pointed out this week, there are what he called other options for getting things done.
How do we manage government where you don't want to go to the House too often with very contentious votes? So instead of legislation, can you have other ways of doing things?
Now, Anthony, you've got this new tome on how the governance of Britain works. To a lot of people, this will sound like a complete inversion of how the government of Britain is meant to work. We're meant to elect MPs who pass laws, and that determines how we're run. Gus O'Donnell seems to be suggesting that there might be other ways of doing it.
Can I correct you on one point? Whatever else my book is, it's not a tome. It's a slim, perceptive volume, as the literary critics say. I think Gus O'Donnell is absolutely right. I've been doing a lot of public speaking recently, and one of the things I try out on people is the idea that I would seriously consider voting for the party and might well vote for the party that promised during its first 100 days it would do nothing at all, and during its first year, it wouldn't do very much. We have far too many laws. Many of them are ill-drafted, ill-thought through, incapable of being implemented. And I think it's at least possible, and I've been trying this idea out on people as well, that if you had a minority government, either a Tory minority government or a Labour minority government, that government would find it much more difficult to do anything that didn't have some kind of broad consensus behind it, wasn't capable of picking up votes in the House of Commons from parties other than itself. I think we might be in for a period of more modest and better government by accident.
Well, so you're sounding quite positive about this. What if we think that one of the most likely scenarios that potentially is a minority Labour government with a kind of grudging night-by-night deal with the Scottish Nationalists, who of course have got their own game about making the government of the UK more complicated rather than less complicated? Do you still think, with all the need to pass budgets through and even just pass regulations, never mind laws, do you still think that could work out quite happily in the way you're saying?
Yes, I do. Partly because I don't think it would be night by night. And going back to the point about our not knowing enough about the internal politics of many of our parties, one of the things that people south of the border don't know nearly enough about is the internal politics, or indeed the public politics, of the Scottish National Party. And my strong impression, and I talked to my spies north of the border, you have to have spies nowadays, I have the very strong impression from them that the SNP is very frightened of the idea of an early referendum, which they believe they would lose, and if they lost it, they would be out of there in terms of gaining independence for at least a generation. They don't want the Conservatives in power. The Conservatives would deal very toughly with Scotland. Why should they do anything else? They want a Labour government in power. Surely the party leadership north of the border has been saying exactly that. And my guess is that the people on the Labour side, and we're now talking game theory, so to speak, yeah, the people on the Labour side would know that in a situation like that, it was the leadership of the Labour Party that held all the cards, not the leadership of the SNP. The SNP, after all, does have this deep historic memory of the famous occasion when they turfed out a Labour government way back in 1979. Jim Callaghan warned them that they were turkeys voting for an early Christmas, and that's exactly what they were doing. There's no reason for the people in the SNP to be confident that the blip that they will gain from on May the 7th will turn out to be anything more than a blip.
Randeep, I mean, what do you think? Like, what would happen to social policy, to the NHS, for example, if the government couldn't rely on getting a big piece of legislation like the Andrew Lansley stuff through, or whatever the equivalent is?
I think there will be, well, there definitely wouldn't be any big bang legislation simply because the legislative process is very long and complicated and subject to many revisions. So corralling kind of, you know, coalition votes through both houses with a bit of ping pong is extremely difficult, especially if you don't have party discipline. And I think that will be the problem. I think this parliament has been the most rebellious in modern history. I think the next parliament will be even more rebellious. And I think that's because partly the coalitions that make up the parties are fracturings as MPs become closer to their electorates. As MPs become closer to their electorates, they're less likely to do what the centre tells them to do, whether that's northeastern Labour MPs or southern Tories. They have their own agendas because they are close to their constituencies. And that will be a real problem. It might have been solved with AV or some kind of PR system, but without it, we're left with a fracturing politics, which means big bang legislation for me, whether it's in social policy or on the NHS. It's kind of written out in the years
to come. Yeah, that'd be a good thing if big bang solutions were ruled out for a bit. I mean, you look at you know what's happened to the health service. You know, parties get in, they feel the need to have a big bang solution to the health service or the education service or both. So you end up with this sort of endless permanent revolution going on in big public services. You know, that Labour did it in between 97 and 99 because it decided it didn't want to spend any more money on public services, so it reformed them instead. What it should have done was give them a bit more money and let them get on with it. I mean, there's sort of, you know, some of the best examples of economic policy in Britain in the last 25 years were when Ken Clark was at the Treasury, where he did pretty much nothing. He just left the economy on autopilot after the shock of Black Wednesday. He just let things go on in their own sweet way, and actually it was a pretty good period. You know, you don't actually need to do loads of stuff all the time.
The Belgium solution.
Belgium, I mean, the people in Belgium had no government for a year and they seemed to do okay out of it.
But come on, let's expand. Belgium, the Netherlands, Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark.
We always write it's a disaster.
Exactly. The notion that you have constantly to legislate, to have a larger and larger volume of regulations, a larger and larger volume. Forget it. I mean, let's not have big bangs. Let's have little bangs. The old textbooks always used to say, and I thought they were very wise, on the whole, unless there's some very good reason not to, proceed incrementally. Start from where you are. Don't pretend you're somewhere else and see if you can just move it on a little bit. Andrew Lansley was forced eventually to admit that he could have achieved practically all of his objectives without that big initial piece of legislation. The big bang was a waste of time.
It's a real triumph of Sir Humphrey, though, isn't it, in some ways? Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of, you know, it's a civil service takeover of the country. It's their sort of ultimate dream, isn't it? You know, the permanent sort of minority government where the civil service actually runs the show.
But it would be a matter of pride, I think, in terms of saying the direction of travel for the country has been set by the coalition and we will only incrementally roll back those changes. Because some of those changes, I think, are fundamental to like the differences between parties, and to sort of cast for, you know, look for votes on the basis that you're kind of not doing very much is quite a difficult sell for politicians, you know.
I'm not sure it is a difficult sell for politicians. I sense that an awful lot of people think that politicians are playing their own in-house games. A Frenchman a long time ago coined a useful expression that's stuck in my mind ever since, la politique politicienne, the politics of politicians. And these enormous manifestos, people are, may or may not, acquire, as Larry suggested, they might, some sort of broad messages from them, but they don't read them in detail. Think these are things thought out by...
But they do matter, don't they? Sometimes, because the House of Lords will nod stuff through, won't it, if it's been in a manifesto.
Manifestos can matter after the event.
Yeah.
Look what happened to the Lib Dems when they went back on their manifesto pledge as regards university fees. They can be important in terms of any negotiations in forming a coalition, or more probably in working out whether there are enough MPs prepared to keep a party in power as a minority. They can be very important. Sometimes wonderfully bad policy comes from manifestos. The Blair government introduced things called independent learning accounts. total catastrophe, open to fraud, tens of, probably hundreds of millions of pounds wasted. And I've been informed reliably, why was it done at all, even though it had many people dubious about it? Why was it done? Because it had been in the Labour Party's manifesto. And the theory of ministers was that we all out there in the country sat there with our manifestos, ticking the boxes, and if they said they were going to do something and they hadn't done it, oh, there'd be all hell to pay. Well, if you believe that, you'll believe anything.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Larry Elliott, to Randeep Ramesh and to Anthony King. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.